So the approach I'll go over is from a paper I wrote on the arc. It's on the archive. From 2001. And there's been a lot of work on this in the last 10 years or so, different sets of postulates from which you can reconstruct quantum theory. And I'm going to, let me first of all give some motivation for this kind of program. So if you look back at the history of physics, then you'll see these kinds of pairings So for example, Kepler's laws for planetary motion, well, they worked in the sense that they gave you the planetary motion, the various properties of planetary motion very well. But somehow they're kind of ad hoc. It's not clear why those particular laws would be the right ones. And then Newton's laws, his laws of mechanics and his gravitational law, provided a kind of explanation for these laws of Kepler. Now, we have to be careful to say that they provide an explanation. I mean, of course, this wasn't the end of the story. Then you have more developments. But there's some sense in which these are clearly, and this is subjective, but there's some sense in which these are clearly better than this. And then you see the same thing again if you look at the Lorentz transformations. These are the transformations under which the Maxwell's equations are invariant, and they're very ad hoc. They're sort of mathematical transformations which have no obvious explanation. And then Einstein gave his postulates for special relativity. And there was a sense in which those explained where these transformations came from. So the idea is that there's a similar situation with quantum theory. If you look at the axioms of quantum theory, like the ones that I gave you at the very beginning, it's not clear where those axioms come from. Why Hilbert space? Why complex Hilbert space? Why all the very structure that's in there? There's some sense in which these axioms are similar to Kepler's laws and Lorentz transformations. So the question is, can we find something to go here? And of course, what I'm going to give you isn't—I don't think—the final word, or even the best that can be said. But if you do find something really satisfying that can go here, then you find yourself in very good company. So it seems like an interesting goal to pursue. And there's a bit more than that. Newton's laws, even if you just look at as they apply to heavenly bodies, then Newton's laws go beyond Kepler's laws. For example, they give you a hyperbolic motion for bodies coming from beyond the solar system. And of course, they give you a lot more than that if you take the full Newton's laws of mechanics, because then you get you know, all of classical mechanics. And likewise, Einstein's postulates for special relativity, well, that led to you know, things like equivalence between mass and energy, which wasn't evident at the level of the Lorentz transformations. And then, of course, it was the natural stepping stone to general relativity. And so it went considerably beyond the original set of transformations. And so it may be that if you can find the most natural way of looking at quantum theory, then you'll find a way to go to quantum gravity or whatever the next physical theory is. Okay. So that's the general motivation. Any questions? No. Good. So, well, if you're going to embark on something like this, if you're going to try and derive quantum theory from some set of reasonable postulates, then you need a place to do it. And you can't assume that you have Hilbert space or the various mathematical elements of quantum theory. You need something more general, a framework within which you can restrict down to quantum theory by imposing the right postulates. So the framework I'm going to tell you about is nowadays goes by the name of the general probability framework, or general probability theories, so G. General and I'll outline the version that I gave in this paper, but actually this has a very long history going back to you know, even the 1950s and 60s. And I'm going to motivate this framework by starting with quantum theory, because that's a place that's something that we're familiar with. So in quantum theory, if we have an experiment like this, we prepare some density matrix, then we make a measurement, and we look at a particular outcome, and we're interested in the probability of this outcome. Well, associated with that outcome is some positive operator. And the probability is given by the trace of that positive operator A and the density matrix. Now, this equation is linear in the density matrix, and what that means is that we can associate, like I showed you before, a list of probabilities that specify the density matrix. So I gave you an example of that previously for a qubit. We can do that in general. And then we can associate a vector with the positive operator associated with the measurement. So the probability can be written down like this. Which is the same as that. And P is a list of probabilities.
Is operator A the projection operator? Is it vector eigenvalue?
So if you're doing a PV measurement, then yes, it would be the projection operator. But you may be doing a POVM, in which case it's the positive operator associated with that outcome. So, so I gave you an example previously. If you have a spin half system, then P can be written as as a list of vectors, sorry, a list of probabilities like this. And in general, and I'll explain this in more detail in a bit, you can write it in quantum theory as a list of k probabilities. And I'll tell you what k is in a bit too. And you know, in the standard framework, the density matrices are positive operators that are that have norm less than or equal to one, so the trace is less than or equal to one. In the case of these p vectors, when you map from rows onto p's, then you'll get some corresponding space of states. So trace. Yeah, like most people like to keep their states normalized, but as I mentioned before, I prefer to keep the freedom not to normalize it. So in the case of quantum theory, so rho exists in some space. Now there's a map from rho to p, and therefore there's a map from this space to some space of p vectors. Yeah, these are probabilities, so they're all numbers between 0 and 1. Yeah. Yeah. Any more questions? Yeah. So I'm using this as a way of getting at what a GPT is. One advantage of the standard quantum way of formulating, of writing down states, is that mathematically this is a very simple space to characterize. You know, you can write, it's very easy to characterize what positive operators are, having trace less than or equal to one. On the other hand, this is a more complicated space to characterize, and the best way to do it really is to convert this back into density matrices and see what it should be. On the other hand, an advantage of using these p vectors instead of rows is that this is a more general way of thinking about probabilistic theories, and it doesn't have to pertain to just quantum theory. In fact, any physical theory where you can define a notion of state. So if you have a preparation and a measurement with some outcome, then you can always characterize the state associated with this preparation by a list of probabilities. What you would do is you would say your state is some mathematical object you can use to calculate any probability, which means that it corresponds to a long list where alpha goes over all possible measurements and outcomes. So alpha labels, there's a different alpha label for every outcome of every measurement. Okay. So if you have this long list of probabilities, then you can calculate the probability for any such situation. This is true in any physical theory. However, this list is perhaps longer than it needs to be. In the case of quantum theory, this list would contain a probability for every single measurement along every angle, all the different angles you might measure the spin along. So it would be an infinitely long list, even for finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So the idea is that there's going to be a more efficient way of characterizing the state with some list that just goes up to k, where you select a subset of alphas and relabel those as 1 through k. And so you can think of this as compressing this long list down to a shorter list. And the important thing is that there is a linear equation that takes you from this shorter list to any of the entries in this longer list. So you can always do this in any physical theory. You can always compress your list down. If there's no structure at all in your physical theory, then you won't be able to compress it down. But then you just work with this long list. But typically, there is some structure so that the probability, in the case of quantum theory, for example, for the measurement along a general direction is related linearly to the probabilities along these four directions. Are there any questions at this stage? So this is a very general way of thinking about physical theories, whereas if you work with density matrices, then you're kind of constrained to think in quantum terms. One thing to notice, so in quantum theory, you can take convex mixtures. So if I have two boxes, one prepares the state rho A, and the other one prepares the state rho B, then I can toss a coin which has a lambda bias on it. And if it comes up heads, which has weight lambda, then I put the box that prepares rho A in. If it comes up if it comes up the other side, then I put the box that prepares rho B in, and then I prepare this state. So we understand that in quantum theory, and that's exactly equivalent in these GPTs to doing that. And if you allow any sort of arbitrary mixing of this sort, which seems very natural, then you know that you can prepare any mixture of this sort. And so your state of states P, the state space S, even in the general case, has to be convex. So it's some shape like this, and it mustn't have the property. So it can't be like this, for example, because this is not a convex space. You can take a state here and a state here, and you can take the convex combination and get states all along here. But these are outside the set that I drew. So it has to be a convex set.
I can't understand what you
draw. No, this is a space of states. I'm just drawing a two-dimensional case. Okay, I could make it three. You know, of course, the dimension of this space should be equal to k. But it has the it has to be convex. It has to have the property that if you take any two points in it, and you draw a line between those two points, you get points that are still in the space.
So, like, this is probability A, and this is probability B.
This is the state PA. This is a state. This is a state B. These are vectors. And then all the vectors in between I can also prepare by taking a convex combination. Is that clear? So they have to be in the space as well. The axis would be the probabilities in this list here. I mean, if you want a more concrete example, in quantum theory, you have the qubit, and there you have a sphere. And you can take points in here and get, and this, so this is a convex shape. Actually, because the states can be unnormalized, you actually get a cone. So the states in the sphere, it's at the top are the normalized states. Okay. Any more questions on this approach? So in the case of quantum theory, I'll show you how to write down one of these p vectors given the density matrix. So what you do, first of all, is you write down a set of positive operators . So n is the dimension of your Hilbert space. So k is equal to n squared in this case. And so you have this many positive operators, and they have to have the property that they span the space of Hermitian operators. I'll show you in a minute why that's true. So it turns out that the space of Hermitian operators is a real space, a real vector space of dimension n squared. The reason for that is if you take any Hermitian operator, see, so this is an Hermitian operator, you can write it down as a linear combination with some coefficients of any linear independent set of operators that span the space, and the number you need is n squared. Okay, and I'll explain where the n squared comes from in just a moment. Yeah, and these are real numbers. The reason they're real is if you were to add together Hermitian operators with complex coefficients, you'd get operators that were no longer Hermitian. So the space of Hermitian operators is actually a real space, a real Hilbert space, and then density matrices are a subset. They're the Hermitian operators that are also positive. So the question, before I do this, let me explain how to use this to get a list of a p vector. Well, you can write down the probabilities you get for each of these positive operators acting on that density matrix. So this is a way to go from rho to p. Okay, and then to explain where the n squared comes from, you just consider a density matrix. Written down in some basis, then along the diagonal of that basis, you have the probabilities associated with each of the projectors in that basis. So that gives you, I'm trying to calculate how many real parameters there are in this density matrix. So we get n, contribution of n coming from the diagonal. And now we have the off-diagonal terms. Well, the upper off-diagonal terms are just the Hermitian conjugates of the lower diagonal terms. So we only need to count how many numbers we have in one of those two places. And we know that each of these numbers are complex. So we need to count a 2 there, because we're counting the number of real parameters. And then we have this many entries above the diagonal. So that's the total number of real numbers we have inside a density matrix. Which is n squared. And this 2 is because we're using complex Hilbert space. So clearly, if you need n squared real numbers to parameterize the density matrix, then you're going to need n squared probabilities in here. So you need n squared linearly independent positive operators. So there's another number that's appeared here, which is n, which is the dimension of the Hilbert space. But we're trying to characterize quantum theory in a more operational framework. So we should give a characterization of what we mean by n that doesn't rely on quantum theory. And we define n to be the maximum number of states that can be perfectly distinguished in a single shot. Okay, so if you have some measurement set up to distinguish states, then the states have to definitely give rise to different outcomes of that measurement. And n is the maximum number of states that can be distinguished in any such situation. So in the case of a qubit, n is equal to 2 because you can set up an experiment that will distinguish 2 states, but not more. Okay. It's interesting. So I've set up, I've shown you how to put quantum theory into this kind of framework. It's interesting to look at what happens in the classical case. We have, if we have n distinguishable states, you could imagine having n boxes with a ball that can be in one of those n boxes, then you can represent the state just by giving a probability distribution over those n distinguishable states. So in this case, in the case of classical probability theory, k is equal to n. So there's something curious happening here. That we get this hierarchy, k equals n to the power r. And I'll actually I'll show you that this equation actually comes from some very general considerations later. No questions? No.
Yep.
in the quantum case, n is the dimension of the Hilbert space. But in operational terms, n is the maximum number of states that can be distinguished in a single shot. Maybe I could explain that a bit more. So imagine you have your different preparations, prepare different states. And then you have some measurement here, which has different outcomes associated with it. And then you have all the possible states that you can prepare. And you're looking for sets of states that have the property that each member of that set gives rise to a different outcome every time. So maybe the first state in your set always gives rise to this outcome. The second one always gives rise to the second outcome, and so on. And so if you have sets of states with that property, then those sets of states can be distinguished using this particular measurement. And then n is the largest, is the rank of the is the largest possible rank of any such set. So obviously, yes, go.
It seems like, so we have an operational meaning for n, but still the dependence of n does kind of depend on the theory.
So the idea is to use some general postulates to get what the dependence of k and n should be, which don't come from the usual axioms of quantum theory.
But to get k equals to n square, we see that we try to take rho as a complex matrix.
So in a sense, all I've been doing here is I've been trying to motivate this more general way of thinking about states as lists of probabilities from quantum theory, because that's something we're more familiar with. But then I'm going to show you a set of postulates that you can use to actually get the structure of quantum theory without starting with it. There's one thing I didn't mention was you could also have transformations. So you can have preparation, a transformation, and then a measurement, some outcome. And you can represent transformations in this framework too. So to motivate that, in quantum theory, the probability, if you have a transformation in your situation like this, then the probability is given by the trace of, well, you take your state, rho, you hit it with a completely positive map, a completely positive trace non-increasing map, and then with a positive operator. And these are linear. They act on the density matrix linearly. So we know that if we write the density matrix, if you transform to this P form, write the state as a P vector, then the effect of the transformation is just given by some linear transformation on P, so given by a matrix acting on P. So we have that. Which is the same as that. So now we have three kinds of objects, states, transformations, and measurement outcomes. And we have some mathematical objects associated with each of those. And each of them lives in some space. So S is the space of possible states. R is the space these possible measurement vectors. And gamma is the space of these possible Z transformations. And you can write quantum theory down in terms of these structures instead. Okay. So before I give you the postulates for quantum theory, I need to discuss one more thing, which is the idea of composite systems. And we're going to see where this k equals n to the power r comes from. So imagine we have some preparation that prepares two systems, label them by A and B. Then an assumption that we can make is that the k, the dimension of the space of states associated with the composite system, is given by the products, by the product of the dimensions associated with each of the components. And we can make a similar assumption for the n's. But neither of these things have to be true, but they seem quite reasonable. And these are going to be two of the postulates that I'll give you later. This postulate goes by the name tomographic locality. So actually, the way this postulate is normally stated, if you call it tomographic locality, is slightly different. What this means is, if you have some some preparation for a state, then you can determine what this state is equal to by making measurements on each of the two halves, on each of the two components, and then collecting the statistics, joint probabilities for the outcomes of these measurements. And if you do that with lots of different local measurements on each of the two sides, then the assumption of tomographic locality is that you can fully characterize the state. So you can determine the state if you have an ensemble, so you have many. You can keep using this box, prepare the state, and then you can perform local measurements on each of the two sides, and you can determine what the state is just by local measurements. This needn't be true. It could be that you have to use a box that is sort of acting them jointly. And one thing that's interesting is that this is true in quantum theory if you have a complex Hilbert space, but it fails to be true if you restrict quantum theory just to the real, just to states in the real Hilbert space, or if you have density matrices that where the off-diagonal entries are restricted to being real. So this is not true of what's called real Hilbert space quantum theory. Yeah, I'll give you a table in a minute and show you how that works out. Yeah. If I have time. This assumption goes by the name information locality. And you can think of it as saying that information adds. So if you take the log of this expression, then the log of n is the total information carrying capacity of the joint system, and that would be equal to log of na plus log of nb. You know, so you know if you've got two memory sticks, and one has 5 gigabytes and the other one has 3 gigabytes, then in total you've got 8 gigabytes, and this is saying the same thing.
Why does it call like
well, so first of all, this is my name, so so that's my fault. But it is a kind of locality property because it's saying that the total information carrying capacity is made up locally of what you have in each of the systems locally. So it could be the case that when you bring two systems together, that you end up having more contributions to n available than you had before. So here's an example. Imagine I have a die, 6 has n equals 6, and a coin has n equals 2. So then according to this, in total you have 6 times 2, which is 12 for the composite system. But it could be that the coin, it could be that the die is actually a safe, and it has locked inside it another coin. And it could be that the coin we were talking about is actually a key, and if it's proximate to the safe, it'll open the safe. So suddenly, when you put the two things together, you have 24 instead of just 12. So it's possible that when you bring these two systems together, that they release some extra information carrying capacity that wasn't there originally. In principle, that is possible. Sorry? Yeah. So both of these are true. In quantum theory, and also in classical probability theory. Okay. So we can use these expressions plus one more assumption, which comes from somewhere else, to show that k should be equal to n to the power r. So let's see. I'll just take that one up. So we want to assume, so if we have those two assumptions, if we have info and tomographic, and actually we need two or three further assumptions. If the dimension associated with a certain type of system is a function of the information carrying capacity for that type of system, and if this function has the property that it's strictly increasing, it would be very strange if this weren't the case. And indeed, given some other even more natural assumptions, you can prove that this must be true. And also, there exist systems which have n equal to 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. Then you can show that k is equal to n to the power r, using a bit of number theory. So what happens is you use these two assumptions to show that this function here is what's called a completely multiplicative function, has the property that this is true. In a number theory, this is called a completely, this sort of functions like this are called completely multiplicative. And then you do a bit of you use a sort of prime factorization of K, and it comes out. It's not the simplest proof, but it's fairly straightforward. So we see that there is this natural hierarchy of theories, and the two theories that we're very familiar with are the first two elements of this hierarchy. So there could in principle be higher theories out there. So there could be, some as yet unseen physics where n is where we have k equals n to the power 3. On the other hand, it's been very difficult to construct actual explicit examples of theories that have r greater than 2. There are some ad hoc examples out there in the literature, but it's quite difficult to construct anything that's remotely natural. Okay. So it's interesting to look at alternatives to quantum theory that still use a Hilbert space and see what happens to them with regard to this relationship. So if k is a polynomial function of n, we can consider writing it in this form. Like this. And what we're doing here is we'll imagine you have some choice of n states that can be distinguished. Then we're saying that for each of these states, we have a contribution of x1 to k. And then for each pair of states, each pair of this set of distinguishable states, we have a contribution of x2. And then for each triple of this set of states, we have a contribution of x3, and so on. So this is one way of thinking of this function. And you can look and see how this function pans out in the case of different theories. So in the case of quantum theory, you just have 1, 2. This is just quantum theory with complex Hilbert space. If we have real Hilbert space quantum theory, then it's equal to 1, 1, like so. Then another thing we can consider is quaternionic. And these two cases are not of the form k equals n to the power r.
K is the number of degrees of freedom.
Yeah. Theory, right? If, yeah, the state space, yeah.
Then how all of a sudden you wrote down A equal F1 and then
I'm just saying if we imagine thinking about K in this way, where we take, we can, so it's sort of motivated by this, what happened here. In this case, we saw that K was, had a certain number of, a certain contribution for each of this set of distinguishable states. Okay, in this case, it was one. Then for each pair of distinguishable states, there was a contribution of two, and so on. Well, remember, I gave this this definition. So we have you can imagine sets of states which are distinguishable. Okay, then you can take one set of states like that, which has the maximum number of distinguishable states in it, and then you can say, well, let's count contributions to K with respect to that set of states. Just thinking about that set of states. It's just a combinatoric exercise. And so this is just one way of counting. Okay. So what we can do then is we can draw this table. So imagine the case where n is equal to 2 and n equal to 4. And we're going to look at it in, we're going to look at what happens to k in real quantum theory, complex quantum theory, and quaternionic. So for quantum theory, we have k equals 4. If we have n equals to 2, because it's just n squared, and if it's n is equal to 4, we have 16. In the real Hilbert space case, if you do the calculation, you can use this. Here you get 3, whereas if n is equal to 4, then you get 10, which you'll notice is bigger than 3 squared. So it's sort of as if you have two real qubits, then there's an extra degree of freedom that can't be accounted for by counting the local degrees of freedom. In the quaternionic case, these are the numbers you get. And it's kind of curious there because it's sort of the wrong way around. When you put together two systems, you seem to lose a whole bunch of degrees of freedom that that should have been there. One reaction to that is to say that really you can't really do quaternionic quantum theory in this context where you allow composite systems. It violates it doesn't just violate the top relationship. It has the property that has this property. So there's actually fewer states for the composite. The state space for the composite system has fewer degrees of freedom than what you would expect, even just by separately preparing the two components. And it sort of doesn't make sense, and it violates certain very natural axioms for these GPTs. Why can't it be the case? I mean, this is just a parameter counting thing. If you do the calculation, this is what you get. I mean, I think the real question is whether you can make sense of this. Is it possible physically to have something like this? And suddenly, if you know, if you can, if you have a preparation over here for some system A, then you have another preparation over here for some system B, and if you can do very, you can do any measurements you want over here without even bringing them together. If the existence of this system doesn't affect what happens here, and if furthermore, if the probabilities for these two experiments just factorize, then you can prove that KAB is greater than or equal to KA times KB. So it seems that quaternionic Hilbert space just doesn't just violate some very basic ideas about how you can do experiments. Okay, so I was going to give you some postulates that you can use to reconstruct quantum theory. I don't have time to do that, so I'll finish this on Friday. Tomorrow, Matthew Pusey is giving a lecture on the PBR theorem and so on. Okay.